and welcome to the President's Podcast of the Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association, also known as the TCYLA. My name is Austin Gardner, and I'm the current president of the TCYLA. The goal of this podcast is to discuss all things legal in Tarrant County, Fort Worth, Texas. Today's topic is Legal Legends, War Stories of Tarrant County Attorneys, where we take a deep dive into a case of a veteran attorney that they feel made an impact in their career. Today, I'm joined with my guest, Mike Schneider. Mike Schneider got his undergrad from Louisiana University, class of 2003, and attended Texas Wesleyan Law School, now known as Texas A&M, where he graduated in 2006. The day after becoming licensed, he founded Schneider Law Firm, PC, which now has 21 employees with 9 lawyers focusing on family law and criminal defense. Schneider Law Firm has 3 fully staffed offices in Tarrant County. Mike is a 9-time super lawyer in criminal defense, and his firm is one of the top 50 business leaders of Fort Worth by the Fort Worth Business Press. Mike Schneider, thank you for joining our podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, Alana, before we get into the case we're going to talk about, a lot of lawyers don't necessarily make that jump straight into opening in their own practice. Why did you do that? And how did you feel law school prepared you or didn't prepare you for that?
Well, I'll tell you this. It was a combination of desperation and stupidity. I actually had probably one good job offer when I graduated. With a very, very successful PI firm here in Fort Worth with a good reputation. But I didn't really apply to many places. And when the guy who brought me in asked me if I'd be happy working Saturdays, I told him flat out I was not interested in that at all. Because in my mind, it was always, well, if I'm going to work 60 hours a week, I ought to be doing it for myself. By that time, I was 26 or 27 years old. I took an alternate path through college. So I already had 2 kids. So working Saturdays, you know, for another person just wasn't an option for me. I kind of lied to my wife, though, and told her that I was really hustling for a job. Because that was kind of the deal. You can start your own firm if you actually try to get a job first. So as far as she knows, I was really hustling for a job. I was not. I had a vision in my head. With regard to did law school prepare me? Well, you know, I got the basic knowledge of the law in law school. But how to run a law practice, I basically learned that from my mentor when I was in law school. I worked for a local criminal defense attorney for 2 years for free. The upside to that was I got to see how she ran her law office, which was kind of handbook how not to run a law office. So I picked up a lot of pointers there. But the thing she did provide me was the opportunity to go to court every day. So every single day, if I wasn't in class, I was there in the courtroom with her, going behind the scenes, meeting the judges. And I actually got to try 2 jury trials with her when I was still in law school with my 3rd year bar card. So that helped. So I got some knowledge from law school, but as far as how to run a law practice, no idea. Had no clue. None.
Yeah, I mean, does anyone really know how to run a law office straight out of law school? I haven't met anyone that has had that ability.
I actually hired an intern early on who is now a practicing lawyer here in the community. And she had worked at a law office in high school. And she was basically telling me, she was like 21, telling me how I should be setting up my files, you know, handling calendaring, because I had no idea. No idea whatsoever. So.
Yeah. Well, hopefully your wife doesn't listen to this podcast, or you can just tell her to skip forward like 6 minutes in so she doesn't find out that you weren't really hustling that hard. All right. So you start your own practice, and part of your own practice, you're doing criminal and you're doing CPS, right?
Yeah. It was criminal and family to start, and I did not want to do family law at all. Because I can't imagine anything more miserable than doing family law. Or at least I thought that at the time. I still kind of do, honestly, if we're all being honest. But yeah, but I wanted to be a criminal defense attorney. That's all I ever wanted to be. But one of the first clients to walk through the door was, of course, a divorce client. And she had money and I had bills. So I started doing family law.
Yeah, a match made in heaven, right? Money and bills. We in Tarrant County, a lot of people don't know that we don't have a public defender's office. We have what they call a wheel. We have that for CPS cases and we have that for criminal cases. And kind of to explain what the wheel is and what that does.
Well, the wheel for family law CPS cases is different than the wheel for criminal law. For criminal law, they have certain basic requirements, and frankly, they're tough to get until you're probably 2 or 3 years in the practice. You have to have a certain minimum number of jury trials. You have to have had a certain minimum number of pleas, certain minimum number of CLE hours. And it goes up the list. So you could start by being on the misdemeanor and state jail list, and then you can get on the third degree list, the second degree list, first degree list, and then, of course, the hyper-specialized capital list. When it comes to family and CPS law, it was kind of a free-for-all almost. And basically, when I didn't have anything else to do, which was a large portion of my first year, you would slink on down to the 4D court, give the judge your card and say, hey, if you've got any debtor that needs representation for not paying his child support, give me a call. Very low pay, unwinnable cases, let's just be honest. But that's kind of where you got to start in family law. And then you would go around to the associate judges back then. And when I started, they didn't even have a will. Each court did their own appointment. So you give the associate judge your card and say, hey, if next CPS docket, you get parents in there who've had their kids removed, give me a call. I'll be happy to represent them. Or you've got a kid who needs an ad litem, give me a call. I'll do that. Or if they have a contempt case and they need to appoint an attorney for somebody looking at jail time, give me a call. So it was basically based on relationships. There were certain people who got the lion's share of the appointments because they were old hands and had relationships with the judges. Otherwise, a lot of times you'd just be standing in court and a judge would holler out, Mr. Schneider, can you take this case? And you'd be like, yeah, sure, I'll take it. I need that $300 that you might get from the county. You know, you were starving to death for money. So that's how that worked back then.
Yeah. And so.
And still the same way, frankly. I mean, they got a wheel thing now, but I mean, it's almost identical process. So.
I would say it is a little more organized since, there's been some shifting around.
Sure.
So now let's kind of get into the case that we're here to talk about today. I'm going to read a Star Telegram article from April 7th, 2007, which is titled Drugs Found in Boy's System. An 8th-month-old baby was given methamphetamine and amphetamine sometimes Thursday before he was rushed to a hospital that day, police said Friday. The baby, whom police did not identify, acted, quote, extremely wired, end quote, when he was treated at Cook Children's Medical Center in Fort Worth, Richland Hill Detective Ty Bell said. The infant did not suffer any life-threatening injuries, police said, but remained in the hospital Friday. He is under Child Protective Services supervision. Doctors could not give me an exact time when the baby would have been given drugs, but she was sure it was sometime during that day, Bell said. The article continues further. Lab tests show that amphetamine and methamphetamine were in the baby's body. In addition, he had caffeine, nicotine, the cough suppressant dextromorphine, and two types of prescription antihistamine in his body, police said. After learning of the test results, police and a drug-detecting dog searched the grandmother's home, and the police found no drugs, but a police indicated that the dog went on alert three times in the home, possible indication of residue. Now, you were not the original attorney on this matter. And frankly, when this article was written, that's correct, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I wasn't brought on until 6 or 8 months after that.
Yeah. And so 10 days after that article is written, you're still not on the case. And it gets picked up by none other than Nancy Grace.
The devil is dancing tonight. Unleash the lawyer. If it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck.
Whoa, please cut her mic.
Cut his mic. It's cut not- his mic. Don't make me cut your mic in the first 3 minutes of the show, please.
Countries,
you can go
you
ahead
no
and cut
on.
His mic. Don't make me cut your mic in the A block. At least let me get to 8:30 for Pete's sake. Rot in hell. And hey, if you're listening, you can put that on your Christmas tree. One-way ticket to hell.
Yes, that Nancy correct. Grace.
That Nancy Grace, correct.
So here's, I couldn't get the a clip, an audio video clip of it, but I do have the transcript. I wanted to read some exchange she had back and forth. And your client, the mother in this case, wasn't on this episode, but they did have recordings and clips of her talking. And it starts with your client saying, "I know it was an accident. I know my mom wouldn't hurt my kids. I know she wouldn't. I probably had it in my system, but I didn't know I was on them that day." And then Grace jumps in after that video clip and says, "Here, have that. This lady is using meth while she's pregnant, 6 months pregnant with another baby. Okay, joining us tonight is the grandmother and the baby's grandmother." And so that she interviews with the grandmother. Grandma says about your client, "I think she's done them in my home. She has a room. She takes friends in there sometimes. We don't know what they're doing. She did do drugs that day, but she didn't do them in my home." And it goes on. She talks to the attorney for your client. The then attorney is not you. And she indicates the mother, in this case, rushed the baby to the hospital. The baby's high on the methamphetamines. And she says, "We're looking to the attorney. What's going on? What's going to happen to your client?" And he responds, "She's going to get treatment. She's going to deal with the issues. She's going to continue to cooperate with the police. And ultimately, I think she will be exonerated of any criminal culpability in these cases." "So you think that she's not going to face any charges at all?" Glaris responds. And he says, "I don't think she'll be free from facing charges." That's essentially the detective and he goes on to say the DA's job. And then he goes on to say, "It's the DA's responsibility to protect the children. I think ultimately evidence is going to show when these symptoms presented themselves, she was not present. Only her mother was present." And to which Grace lovingly responds, "Sir, she's pregnant now. She's on meth with the baby." It goes on. I mean, Grace kind of takes grandma and her attorney over the coals on this. She gets people to call in. People are saying this mom should never have her kids back. It's quite the read. And you inherited this case with all this media attachment already on it.
Right. And frankly, when they came into my tiny office in Arlington, I had no idea about any of this, none of this. Frankly, I didn't have much idea about the entire CPS system at this time in my career. I had no idea what a permanency review was. I had no idea how an intervener worked in a CPS case. I mean, all these things that would come into play. I never personally handled a CPS case when they sat down. But I was not in the business at that time of turning away a possible client, no matter how little money they had. Like I say, these were the early days. So when I met with them, I had no idea all this was going on.
Yeah. So you get on this case and kind of set the stage. There's interveners. What are interveners? Who else? Who are all the players in this case? And kind of what are the facts besides sure. The ones I've obviously mentioned?
Sure. So by the time I got on the case, it was interesting because my client, who was the mother of the child, had already had her baby, who during the time of the Nancy Grace interview was still in utero. But she had the baby with her there at the meeting with me, which I found fascinating. You know, they took one baby, but she had this baby with her, which I just figured they were going to scoop up. And that was the initial thing they said, was they were worried that they were going to show up and take that baby at any moment. She also brought her mother, who was actually interviewed by Nancy Grace. And if you read the full transcript, the mother did my client no favors, threw her under the bus, just was like trying to shed all the blame she possibly could on her own daughter. When in fact, and I don't think this is any mystery to anybody, and the investigation will show, she was as much of a user as her daughter was. And that is a fact. She had a criminal history. She was and by no means ignorant of the drug game or anything else, but there she was with her, which of course I didn't know at the time that she would end up being my jury trial villain. I would put all the responsibility off on her, but so they present to me, and basically the story I get is, we're doing this good. She's doing great with CPS. She's done everything they've asked. She's been clean for 5 months. The baby was born clean. Everything's going great. She's got a job now. She's got her own apartment, but they're just not giving the kids back. And I said, well, that doesn't seem right. Of course, I didn't know the whole story. And then they said that the foster parents were now trying to take the kid. And I had no idea if that was even legal or illegal at the time. I didn't know anything about CPS cases. But I agreed to try to help them. They had a court-appointed attorney at the time for the CPS case. And so I was basically, well, I'll take the case for $1,200, which is a ridiculously low fee. Of course, they didn't even have $1,200. They had $500. And that $500 was the last money I ever saw in the entire case. The case ended up going on for, I think it went on for another 7 or 8 months at that point, and through the end of a jury trial. So that's what I walked into. I walked into a case I didn't know had been on national news. I didn't know there'd been articles written about it throughout Texas and featured on Nancy Grace. I had no idea what was going on, but I took the case and I basically stepped into a mess right from the get-go.
Yeah. And, you know, someone who's been in family law for a little while, and you've been in family law, obviously, longer than I have, you know, you can become a little, I guess, used to, I hate to use the word jaded, but used to parents with facts similar to these, parents using methamphetamine. And for us, yeah, it's a big deal. And you obviously, you know, want to treat it with the seriousness that it deserves. But to the layman that exists out there and may not be used to hearing methamphetamine all the time, you know, it's a very big deal to your regular Joe Schmo on the street. You know, this is, a lot of people will say this, you know, this is meth. You know, this is one of the most addictive drugs out there, you know, ruins people's lives. And there is a certain sensationalism when you have that word meth, when you throw that word meth out there. And like you said, Grandma, she, even on Nancy Grace, said, quote, "I have used drugs in the past, but I do not use drugs now. I know the father's family all do drugs." So she's aware everyone's doing drugs. Yeah. I used to do them too.
But now she's miraculously clean. Somehow she had found the straight and narrow. Well, I want to make this point. You know, when we're talking 14 years ago, meth was still relatively new on the scene. We were coming out of the crack epidemic. So a toddler presenting at the hospital actually high on methamphetamine was a huge story. Nowadays, I don't even know if it'd get picked up, honestly. But that was a huge story back then, and very shocking to everybody. Oh my Lord, how did a 2-year-old end up with high on meth? So interesting and tough to deal with, I'll be honest.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it probably about half to 70% of my cases involve methamphetamines to some degree. And I don't know I don't know if any of my cases have been picked up by national news, more especially, right. Even local news for that. So you get the case, you got interveners who are foster parents, they've intervened in the case and they have representation. Tell me about the intervener. So there's a foster parent.
Foster parents, and they were great people. There was nothing wrong with them. I did some digging on them. They were great people. They were everything you would hope a foster family would be. except they went into fostering with the pure intent to adopt a babe.
As a lot that do.
That was their goal. They weren't just doing it to be a foster parent. They were doing it as a means for adoption. So what happened in this case, and actually, after I called around and talked to the CPS caseworker, the CPS attorney, who was James Teal, fantastic attorney, ended up being a great associate judge and now runs the local private placement operation. He was the attorney on the case, and come to find out, my client was telling the truth. She had actually done what she was supposed to do. Everything that was in the safety plan, which I didn't even know what a safety plan was back then, all those goals she was supposed to meet to where, you know, if she did all these things, she might get her kid back. She had actually done 95% of it. She had gotten clean, stayed clean, gotten a job, done drug treatment. She actually went to a residential facility for a while. She had done everything CPS asked them to do. But there was a problem. The problem was this was a notorious case, and the interveners had gotten word that she was actually getting back on track, so they lawyered up because they didn't want to turn the kid back over. So basically, that's what I walked into, and it presented a unique set of challenges because, you know, I might be able to take on, in my mind, I said, look, I might be able to beat CPS or I might be able to beat the interveners, but I can't beat them both. I mean, got James Teal on one side who knew more about CPS cases than anybody else in this county, probably in North Texas, representing CPS. We had the lawyer for the interveners, very well known, very respected in the foster parent circle, had tried terminations before, both defending them and tried them, and also formerly worked for CPS as a caseworker. There was no way I was going to be able to take them both on and win this case. So it presented a unique set of challenges. Then you add on top of it, I knew my shortcomings. I didn't know anything about CPS. And then I'd sit down and read the code, and it felt like I knew less about CPS because it didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. So. Not only that, but you also have an attorney representing the children as well. And
correct. Yeah. And the attorney representing the children was a hard no on giving the kids back. Hard no. And she was a feisty attorney. She still practices. Fantastic. Kind of made her living representing children in these contentious CPS cases. I mean, she probably got 80% of these CPS cases. These high notoriety CPS cases. So I was in way over my head.
And so when a family gets separated, when there's a removal of children, you're talking about a service plan. For those who don't know, a service plan is assigned to parents to alleviate the concerns of CPS. So if there's drug concerns, they give them drug counseling, they give them drug testing to check their sobriety. Usually they'll do some kind of like individual counseling to address some of the reasons that they're using, things like that. So, you know, with these kind of cases, your average person on the street may say, well, look, you know, she had her chance. You have these amazing foster parents out here. Why can't we just give to the foster parents? You know, they seem like good people. You know, mom had her chance and she messed up. What would you say to those people?
Well, I'd say in a lot of cases, thank God for foster parents. But I will tell you, my beliefs about this follow exactly with the Texas Family Code. And the Texas Family Code says, we should prioritize biological parents who show that they are fit to take care of their kids. That's in the law. And I firmly believe that. Even if it didn't say that in the law, I'd firmly believe it. You got to remember, I'm a criminal defense guy at heart. So fighting the state and their ability to put people in prison or snatch kids out of a home offends my sense of liberty to an extent. Now, I'm no fool. I know it's necessary. And I know it's a no-win situation a lot of times for the state. I don't think they get a lot of joy from doing it, but especially in this case, when I found out they made her a list of things she would, if she did these, she could have her kids back. Once I found out she had done that, and then the system was getting played in such a way where that wasn't going to happen, that especially offended my sense of what we're supposed to be doing in the courthouse. I didn't take it personally against CPS. I knew the, you know, understood the political pressure they were under. And I understood the reality is, who knows if after they gave the kids back, whether mom would fall off the wagon, who knows if that would even be the right choice. So what I decided to do was, given the fact that she had done everything CPS had asked her to do, I decided to play this case a little different. I decided that I was going to do everything in my power to make CPS our ally. So the very first thing I did was I picked up the phone and I started working the caseworker and I started talking to James Steele. And my position was never, why the hell did you take these kids? Because that would be a stupid position. My position was never, why haven't you already given them back? Because I realized the political issues involved there and the uncertainty of it. And the simple fact they could, because now you had an intervention in the case with the foster parents saying, Judge, we don't want you to move the kids at all until we have a jury trial. So there, that would have been a losing battle. So what I did was I started working CPS and talking to James about the fact that my client was actually, despite how bad her story was when she ended up here, she is now a success story for CPS. She has done what you've asked. She's gone above and beyond, you know, and I had all these examples of ways she's overcame. And I started playing towards that. And I went to the CPS caseworker, who I could tell, even with my lack of experience, didn't have a whole lot of experience. And I said, look, you really did a good job with this girl. I appreciate you working with her. Thanks for being patient, making sure she had the services and just playing a little bit to her, you know, her desire to be recognized in a job where there's no recognition. And then I went to the Star Telegram and I had them come back out and interview her because she, you know, she had never given her story before other than the things she had said in court. And I brought to their attention, this is a success story for CPS. I want to thank James Till at CPS and the caseworker for giving her the opportunity to do this. But Star Telegram, we got a problem. We got these foster parents who are in this for the wrong reason. Thank God they stepped up when they did, but they should not be standing in the way of a mother who's proven that she is ready to move on with her life. This is not how the system's supposed to work. So once that article ran and I got on record as that's my position, it was a lot easier to work with CPS. And CPS eventually came around to the position. You know what? He's right. When we go to these people and we say, we're taking your kids, but if you do X, Y, and Z, and you show us you're serious about being a good parent, we need to kind of try to honor our word. And that made the deal. You know, that made the whole case. Then it became me and CPS against the foster parents and the ad litem. And that was a lot more manageable.
And it was a jury trial. You know, I think it's no secret that, you know, judges see these kind of cases a lot more, maybe not meth back in 2007, but just in general, these types of cases. But you have a jury trial ahead of you, which is obviously a lot more work and has a lot more unknown factors in it. Because like we talked about earlier, Joe Schmo is not used to hearing children on high on meth.
Right. And yeah, there was no way I would let this case, even though I was very fearful of my lack of knowledge, despite the fact I was working hard to get caught up on that. I knew I could try a jury trial case. I knew I could do that. You know, I might, you know, stumble a little bit on some of the principles of CPS procedure, but I knew once that jury showed up, I could do that. So there was no way I was going to let the judge hear the case, because simply no judge is going to want to be the judge that gave the Tarrant County meth mom her kid back. I mean, that's the next thing you know, their face is up on pictures up on Nancy Grace and the world's on fire. So it, to me, the only option was a jury trial. And frankly, that the foster parents wanted a jury trial too. They wanted that also. So
you start your jury trial, you begin your opening, and you probably get some into your actual case in chief. Tell me what happened next.
I almost had an emotional breakdown is what happened next, honestly. We are midway through the first witness And the judge takes a break. It was a visiting judge assigned to hear this case because, frankly, no judge wanted to hear it because of the notoriety. And we went back in the chambers, and the judge, very, very well-respected retired judge, looks at us and goes, guys, I got a problem. And it was quiet. We were all looking at each other. The administrative judge never actually signed my order appointing me to hear this case. And basically what that meant is the 2.5 days we had already spent down there doing a long jury selection, doing a huge first witness, every bit of that time was now without jurisdiction. Everything that happened up to that point, every ruling she had made was without lawful authority. And we would have to start over. So we lost 2.5 days, and the word on the street was, we're going to have to dismiss the jury. They were going to have to do a new appointment because that judge could not stay for another week. She had other commitments. We were going to have to take a day off and then repick the jury. By that time, that would have been a Friday, and then start back, hopefully, with the jury sat on Monday, but maybe probably Tuesday next week. And the problem with this was I was still a small lawyer. I was living off the money that came through the door. It was bad enough that I'd already spent 3 weeks in preparation and picking this jury in the lead up to it, almost exclusively focusing on this case. All I could think in my head was, oh my God, if I've got to do a whole nother week of jury trial, I'm going to go bankrupt. I don't have the money. By then I had one assistant. I couldn't even pay the assistant. I mean, I walked out into one of the conference rooms and was just like, this case is going to bank. But, you know, all I'd ever made on the case was $500. Here I am 8 months in. I'd probably spent 300 hours on the case. And I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. It was so devastating. but anyway, what do you do? What do you do?
What do you do? So the case has a mistrial because of this, and you have to start over. How did the case actually go once you got into the groove?
It took a while. I think it went another 5 days after we seated the jury, and it went great. And one of the reasons it went great is, number one, and I got to give full credit to James Teal. James Teal, the CPS attorney, was a pro. He was a real pro. And he was just a professor-like demeanor to him, where he had his agenda, he had his list. And that meshed real well with me, who was kind of a little more performance-based, a little more, at times passionate, at other times, you know, sarcastic, mocking, a little bit of joking, not much joking because it was such a serious case, but we really worked well together. And he was kind of like my backstop. You know, because I knew we were on the same page and we were going to be asking for the same thing at the end of the case, it went well. The other advantage, really, because I'd tried, I had a history with criminal defense and evidence. I mean, evidence is so important in the criminal practice. It just felt like I had an advantage over the other family lawyers because there's this sense in family court that the rules of evidence don't always matter. But the judge they brought in, Judge Cleveland, who was not a former Tarrant County judge, he was a general jurisdiction judge out from Palo Pinto County. The judge they brought in after the other judge had to leave, he was a stickler for the rules of evidence. He was a stickler for procedure. So that gave me a big advantage in the trial with regard to limiting the testimony in front of the jury, hearsay, my objections. These things that may fly with a family court judge were not going to fly with him. He was going to follow the rules. So that was a big blessing. So actually, in my mind, the mistrial ended up playing in our favor. So that was a beautiful thing.
So the jury hears the case, they hear the evidence, and they return a verdict.
Correct.
What happened?
Well, you got to understand, in any CPS case, anybody who's tried a CPS jury trial, especially with these kind of facts, will tell you a win is your client living to fight another day, not getting the proverbial death penalty and have her parental rights terminated. You know, and the jury found that there was reason to believe that there was clear and convincing evidence that she had engaged in conduct detrimental to the child, but they ruled it was not in the best interest for her rights to be terminated. So she was left on as a conservator, actually a conservator with the foster parent. So they were now going to have to be working together to raise this child. She would have visitation rights. She would have rights to go to school functions. She would have rights to be involved in medical decisions. All the rights that come along with that, she would have those rights. And potentially one day she may have the right to petition to have it modified and have the child come back and live with her. It was huge. I mean, nobody thought that would happen. You know, you kind of start drinking the Kool-Aid during a jury trial. But if you ask me in my heart of hearts if we were going to survive, I'd probably say we don't have a great chance. But the jury did it. And the jury really bought into the contention that, you know what? This is what we want to reward in society. This is the conduct we want to reward. So, you know, let's take a chance on this girl. Let's give her the chance that we, you know, we as a society tell parents they get if they mess up. So it was a beautiful thing. Jury hung around and congratulated us and tried to talk to her. My client thought in her mind she had lost, and she was not happy with me. She was not happy with me at all. She wanted to leave that day with the kid. And I was like, that never was the plan. So anyway, that was frustrating, but that's how the case ended. It was a beautiful thing. And, you know, and it really gave me a lot of confidence going forward.
So she gets to fight another day. She doesn't have her parental rights terminated. What do you think is the most important lesson you learned from that trial?
Get paid up front. The most important thing about that trial is, you know, some cases you've got to take them early in your career. You got to take them to make a name for yourself. You don't just get to show up one day and charge $40,000 for the big cases. You got to earn that right. And if you don't try these cases, these $500 cases, when the odds are stacked against you, even if you expect to lose, then you don't have any right to demand the $40,000 10 years from now. That's what you learn from that. And if you take those cases, you better work your ass off.
Well, that is a good lesson for, I think, any attorney, more especially a young attorney, to learn. So thank you for sharing that story.
I want to make one point just to wrap up the story. 8 months later, I get a call. I'm no longer her attorney. And she had voluntarily relinquished her parental rights to the foster parents. So after all of that, heartache, tears, late nights, 8 months after it, she signs over rights to the foster parents anyway.
Sometimes you just can't win.
No, you can't.
This has been Austin Gardner with the Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association Presidents Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to our series on legal legends, war stories of Tarrant County attorneys. We hope you subscribe to our podcast and join us for future episodes. I want to thank our guest, Michael Schneider, for joining us today. For more information about what is happening with our organization, please check out our website at www.tcyla.org. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time on a brand new episode of the TCYLA Presidents Podcast. Have a great day.